just take number six, the morning of November the 11th. Mr. President, you were ruminating on some of the unfinished business, which I suppose every president has.
Yes.
You want to go on with that?
Well, every president, of course, has certain projects in view at the end of his administration, and he is more in that position than he would be under other circumstances for the simple reason that he's had a chance to think over everything that's taken place. And naturally, there are things that he'd like to see carried out that he can't naturally carry out when he comes to the end of his term. And of course, wasn't anything of, I'd say, particularly vital importance except our relationship in foreign affairs, in which I was most vitally interested. But there wasn't anything to be done about it.
Well,
at
but
that
to
time.
Come to this very important business of turnover, you concerned yourself for the first time in the history of the American presidency with the task of turning over every important function of the government to the new administration to make sure there wasn't going to be any possible lapse of functioning because of the importance and the gravity of the times in which we were living.
That's true. I called in the president-elect. I had him sit with the cabinet and had each member of the cabinet report the situation and what needed to be done. And then I invited the president-elect to send his budget director to the White House because I had to make the last budget that he would be associated with my budget director. I also asked him to send his prospective secretary of state, his prospective secretary of defense, and all the rest of the members of the cabinet to come and have their programs and approach coordinated. He also sent Sherman Adams over to the White House. And I turned him over to John Steelman and told him that he could find out just exactly how things worked. And one of the difficulties I had with him, he wanted to take over, and I told him that I was still the president, would be until the 20th, but we would give him every help and information possible so he could set up the White House staff in such a way that it would be of use to him. That was true of every member of the cabinet and all the government. The first time in the history of the country that that was ever done.
Do you remember on what date that was, your meeting with the...
About a week after the election.
Week after the election.
It happened in November, and I invited the president to come over and sit with the cabinet.
That's all in the memoir.
Yes, I'm
just wondering about Sherman Adams asking for immediate charge. Did he ask you to take
him? No, he came in and tried to take immediate charge, and I called him in and told him that I was still the president, that he was only there on sufferance, and if he wanted to find out what went on, all in the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue, you can sit down, as far as I was concerned.
You mean he actually wanted to take over?
Well, the operation of the White House, which I wouldn't let him do. I was still friendly.
On what grounds would he not do
there
it?
On Sunday, therefore.
He tried
to take over my administrative staff and tell them what to do, and I told him he couldn't do it. And that's all it was. It wasn't a request, he just did it. And I called him in and told him he couldn't. That's all there was to it.
Now, Mr. President, the business of turning over an administration during a crisis, the kind that prevented FDR from wanting to abandon his office and keep him going. You knew the relative difficulties in those areas.
That's
where
right.
You did.
That's right. And I tried to help him all I could.
Well, but there's a cutoff. This is the point on which your comment would be interesting. Does a president who has to familiarize himself suddenly go in? How do you cushion against this kind of sudden shock?
Well, the objective I had in view was to do that very thing. I called in the president-elect, had him sit with the cabinet, told him to send his functionaries who were going to follow in the steps of the members of the cabinet and his staff who were going to work in the White House, come in and they'd be shown the programs that had been followed and the function. And the only difficulty I had was with the man who was supposed to take over the White House staff. He wanted to run my staff and I wouldn't let him. That's the only difficulty we had.
Well,
but all the rest of them were informed on exactly what the situation is that was at that time and what they had to do to continue it.
Well, how could all these new cabinet members come in and take charge without knowing, even if they were briefed?
They couldn't. But being briefed and being allowed to sit with the members of the cabinet and see what the functions were, they didn't have any trouble.
Well,
it was the most orderly turnover that had ever made in the White House.
Of course, previous presidents, went on the theory that there are always these civil, they over and they...
Not in the executive department. They don't happen in the president's cabinet or in his staff in the White House. That's only in the regular functions of the government outside the White House. They're not a civil service that stay with the White House.
Would you recommend a permanent secretariat of some kind that way in order to cushion this thing?
No.
Could you have one?
No. But what he wants. And nobody can tell him what he wants to do, particularly the man he's succeeded.
This is a practical matter. Here you have one of the great industrialists come in as Secretary of Defense.
Briefed and told exactly what the situation was and what he had to do. But he thought he knew more than the fellow was briefing him. And that fellow happened to be Lovett.
Those tragedies.
Well, they arise from the fact.
Policy and Treasury, we understand that.
They arise from the fact that the fellow who's elected should reflect on the previous administration. And that's what he tried to do, and it didn't work. He had to come around afterwards. But he had the best chance in the world of any president that's ever taken over to have a complete outline of what the situation was. And if he wanted to change it, wasn't any harm in wanting to change it. That was his business, that the new policy. But he had the idea that if he could reflect on his predecessor, that would be to his credit. It didn't turn out.
There's always some feeling about an incoming administration to want to discredit its previous administration, preceding administration.
Well, there shouldn't be, unless there's a change of political parties, which there was in this instance. But there shouldn't be. The objective ought to be to find out exactly what is the policies have been, what they what is anticipated that they will be, and then, when the man takes over, he should then try to, as easily as he can, change his policies into those from those that are in effect. And if he can't do that, then it's all right to upset the apple cart. And that's what they had in mind, was to upset the whole apple cart, make it appear that I hadn't been a president. Well, it didn't work.
Well, but a tremendous expense, and what you're saying, in effect, is that the damaging consequences of this miscarriage of administration by the present one going to be on the books for a long time, and its real consequences will not be apparent for many, many years to come, long after they're out of office.
That's true, and there's only one parallel to it, and that's when John Adams left the White House at midnight so he wouldn't have to make a turnover to Jefferson. That's the only one that I know of in the history of the country.
But at any rate, those arise out of political differences.
Oh, yes, they arise out of, I'd say, bonehead foolishness.
Well, this could not be political differences. This was personal differences.
That's all.
This is.
It was a program to discredit the fellow who had preceded him in every way he possibly could. And I don't think that's the right attitude for a president to take over the office. Because any man who's been president, whether you like him or not, has to be a man or he couldn't be president.
Well, but that's not a privileged attitude. This is a presumptive attitude for a person to take, and
pin-headed. It's a pin-headed personal attitude of a fellow who doesn't know anything about politics.
Well, how do you protect the country from this kind of thing?
You can't.
Because
it has to depend absolutely on the attitude of the man who's president when this turnover is made.
Well, here you have a your party in control of the Congress.
That's right. But not in 52. That was
well
in
56. And they had never been able to cushion the blow, and they'd never been able to exercise enough power to protect the preceding administration over which you presided. How do you account for that?
Well, I think maybe it's a good thing. You know, the succession in monarchies, in and dictatorships. It's made on the basis of who's going to be a better dictator, or what the next monarch going to do. King is dead, long live the king. And our turnover ought to be orderly. And the man who is present and going out can make it orderly if he wants to try to do it. And after that, why, it's just an approach of a new administration. And it's the approach in a republic and a good thing. I don't see anything wrong with it. Although you get disgusted sometimes when a man has a chance to take over an orderly transfer and doesn't have sense enough to do it. That's all there is to it. And that's a reflection on my success.
Well, entirely apart from this public relations thing that a president is supposed to assume for his own personal role, what is the most important single thing that he has to do to keep the country united on policy?
He has to have as friendly a relationship with the Congress as he possibly can have, and he has to have a cabinet who will carry on the programs which the policies of the administration call for. And those cabinet members must be in a position to turn over their functions to their successors in a way so that the orderly carrying on of the functions of the government can be carried out. That's all there is to it. And it's hard to do. It's hard to do.
Yes. Right. You say keep the country united. Don't you mean to keep the leadership going? The country doesn't necessarily have to be united.
No. Well, you know what I mean. To keep the government running in an orderly way, just like you would if the new president came into a great corporation.
Actually, what you're saying is you want the country exercised and in turbulence and in conflict all the time to keep generating new ideas.
That's the idea. Well,
are we all through here?
Yes, we're now at the end of tape 6, and I think that'll do for today, November
11th. We've had a lot.
Project the personalities and achievements and the failures of presidents, the events will fall into place. Now, we'll get to Martin Van Buren, and just as a starter, it is said that Martin Van Buren is the first president who actually employed spoils politics as part of his administration.
Well, I think that's a wrong interpretation. He was the successor of Andrew Jackson, whose idea was that the people who worked for him ought to be loyal to him. And he fired the Federalists and the Whigs out of his administration. And then Martin Van Buren followed through on it. I don't think Martin Van Buren ought to be charged with the spoils system. I don't know. Call it the spoil system, but it's a system in which an executive has to have people who are loyal to him when he tries to carry out his program.
Well, perhaps the other definition was that he was labeled as the first political boss in the White House.
He was very well thought of in his state of New York, and in that capacity, I think Jackson was willing to take him as his vice president. As you remember, he was sent to Europe as an ambassador to Great Britain, and he was
rejected
by the Senate. And then later on, Jackson made him his candidate for vice president.
Now, beforehand, just to get that into perspective, there were the political power exercised by some of his predecessors in the case of Jefferson. He was supposed to be autocratically disposed towards the organization, but then he more or less persuaded his followers by sheer intellectual brilliance and his platform and his philosophy.
That's true. Jefferson was the first president who had to be elected by the House of Representatives. And that was brought about by Aaron Burr, who was supposed to be nominated for vice president. And had Aaron Burr been willing to accept his position as vice president, no telling what would have happened to the country, because he would then have been the successor to Jefferson.
Well, the point I'm trying to get at, sir, is that the political necessities of the president required him to be engaged in political maneuvering. Now, Jefferson didn't maneuver, he merely inoculated his following with the brilliance of his philosophy.
That's so true, but the president has to be the head of his party.
Well, Jackson didn't exercise it, as it's noted in some of these things. He is supposed to have let his subordinates do all of his political infighting for him.
Well,
he remained above it.
Jackson was the man who organized a program where the president would not have to be nominated by the House of Representatives. He's the first one who did that. And of course, then he was the leader of his party. And if you remember, in the dinner that was given, Jackson said to the Federal Union, it must be preserved. And that made South Carolina and all the states who afterwards seceded understand that the United States was a going concern and could not be broken up by a minority.
Well, specifically about political patronage, was Jackson the first one to indulge in political patronage?
Yes, he was the first one who fired the people out of the various departments who were not on his side.
And you?
And I approve of it.
And you feel that he was doing that in order to have loyal...
In order to have a program that he could carry through. And he carried his program through because his objective was to see that the United States Bank didn't control the finances of the government of the United States.
Therefore, the statement that Dave just made, based on reading Bruce, that Van Buren was really the first political patronage dispenser...
He just followed the example that Jackson set for him.
Well, now, Van Buren was not the most brilliant man of his period. We've got a visitor. How are you?
Fine, Mr. President.
How do you size up Van Buren as a conservative, liberal? What was he?
And his place in history. What has he achieved as you saw it?
Well, Martin Van Buren was Andrew Jackson's vice president, and he was elected president because Andrew Jackson wanted him to be elected president. He had a very serious situation to meet because there was a panic as a result of the speculation in land after Jackson left the White House. And that speculation brought on a depression in Van Buren's administration, which was not necessarily to be charged to him. But Van Buren was a politician who believed in fixing things on a basis that would bring in the greatest results. He was presented with the idea of bringing Texas into the Union, and he wouldn't make a decision on it. And that's the principal reason why he was not reelected for his second term. Old William Henry Harrison, who was a resident of Indiana at Great Bend, was elected with John Tyler. And he insisted on riding to the White House on a white horse with his uniform on a cold day, and a month after that he was dead, and then John Tyler became President of the United States.
Hold that, Mr. President. We'll get to these two in in order. We'll get back to Van Buren because...
All right, go ahead.
You were talking about the Great Panic of 1837. Now, that was a very, very major...
It was. It was brought about by speculation in land which had been opened up for settlement. And it was paper speculation. And, of course, it brought on a very great depression. And Martin Van Buren handled it best he could. But there wasn't much he could do at that time because he did not, at that time, understand what the powers of the president are. And that really was one of the principal reasons why he wasn't reelected. But the thing that really put him out of the running was his inability to make up his mind on the admission of Texas as a state into the Union of the United States.
What do you feel was his position with regard to that? Well, why did he hesitate?
Because he didn't know which side the popular opinion would be on. If he'd had any convictions on what ought to be done, he wouldn't have had any trouble. But he was always listening to see what the most people thought. And you can't do that when you're in a place of responsibility. You got to make up your mind on the basis of what you think's right, then go ahead with it.
Well, how did his failure to decide about Texas militate against him?
All the South voted against him on that account. And that's the reason he was defeated.
Well, was the slavery question involved in his refusal to admit another slave state?
I don't think it was seriously involved. The idea was to have a balance in the Senate of the United States. Didn't make any difference about the House. But there was a balance of power between the North and the South at that time. And that's what brought it about.
But to get back to the panic, now, this was a very severe panic, and it caused tremendous hardships that involved every level of society to the point where even businessmen and financiers who had a certain antagonism to government were looking and asking the president to do something about it, and he did not do it.
No, he didn't, because he didn't understand what the powers of the president are. And that's the reason he failed.
Would you say that his inaction was based upon a personal philosophy about the role of government in the economy?
I don't know whether he had any personal philosophy on the role of government. He was a politician who was listening to what might happen and keeping his ear to the ground to the point where he couldn't act as the chief executive of the greatest nation at that time in the Western Hemisphere.
Mr. President, you once said that as a result of Jackson leaving no debt, federal debt, elements of panic developed in the following administration.
I think that's true. I think that's true. Jackson arranged things so that he paid off the whole national debt. Well, the national debt is an asset to an administration in this way, that it shows the people that the government is solvent, that the government has the ability to make loans and take care of things at a time of emergency. And had Martin Van Buren restored that debt to prevent the panic, I don't think he'd had any serious trouble, but he didn't have the nerve to do it.
He was known as, is that why he was known as the cautious Dutchman?
That's right. Well, he was a cautious Dutchman. In fact, he was too cautious. He was always listening to what might be the result of what he might do. What he should have done is gone ahead and do what is necessary to be done and then listen to what happened.
In other words, Mr. President, you consider a national debt as a sign that the credit of a government is good.
That's right.
But can't it also get out of proportion?
No, I don't think so. Whenever it gets out of proportion, there's no government. And whenever that happens, then you better look out. But I don't think it ever has happened in the history of the world. The British were more deeply in than any other government up to the time that we took over for them in the Greek and Turkish program and other things that took place after that. But the British government hasn't gone to pot.
But they did, in a certain sense, have to wipe out debts so that
the did that by lowering the price of the pound.
It is said of Van Buren that he regarded that depression as a cyclical thing that occurred at certain intervals and that
They were inevitable, and we'd go through that.
Necessary to go through with, but he was wrong. It's not necessary for it to come about. And when you have a man in the White House who knows the history of the country and the history of all government from the beginning to now, he doesn't have any trouble meeting things. Franklin Roosevelt's the best example of that.
In other words, you feel that wherever a critical situation such as a panic arises, you can avoid the so-called cyclical business by the government doing something.
Meeting the situation, that's right. And the government has to meet it. Nobody else can.
Well, you take the position that these can be prevented now instead of just having to be met as emergency.
I'm sure they can. They've been met in two administrations and can be met again if it's necessary.
Would you say how, what steps the president takes to meet these crises?
Well, if you read the message of Franklin Roosevelt in 1933, when he took office on March the 4th, you'll find out one way to meet them. And then in times after that, when the situation developed and they found out that the president was willing to take action, why, the panic stopped. That happened in 46 and in 49 also.
This is the end of tape number one, December 7th, the morning of December 7th.